this is Beyond the Barracks, a podcast about the many and varied journeys of Australia's ex-service men, women and their families, brought to you by RSL Victoria.
In each episode, we'll interview a guest, sometimes two, about their life in service and life after service, exploring the many highlights and challenges that they may have faced along the way.
Beyond the Barracks is a podcast for veterans and their families to tell their stories. Sometimes we may discuss experiences and issues that some listeners may find distressing. Please check the show notes for support services.
We acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. RSL Victoria and the Beyond the Barracks team recognises the service of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, just as we recognise the service of all Australians. We are proud of the contribution they have made and continue to make to the Australian Defence Force.
So today we're joined by Joel and his wife, Elisa Sardi. Joel served in the Australian Army for 5 years as a rifleman in 7 RAR Unfortunately, following his deployment in Afghanistan, had a life-changing episode that left him as a quadriplegic. So I'm really interested today in chatting to not only Joel, whose story I think everyone knows quite well, but his wife, Elisa, who has been by his side, a story of enduring love and support.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
I don't think she's really spoken very much about it before.
No, I don't think we speak enough about the partners either, or give them a chance to share their stories. I also think that this is going to set us a really good precedent for the rest of the podcast series, because we do want to tap into the important service that partners provide as well. So, really excited about this.
Thank you both for joining us. Harry and I are very excited. What we'd like to, I guess, start with is understanding, Elisa, where this all began. Where did the love start with Joel?
So Joel and I met back in 2008. We were in year 12. It was actually my friend's 18th birthday party, and she had a twin brother. Joel was friends with her brother. So we went over to her house. I mean, there's two sides to this story as well, my side and Joel's, but this one's obviously the right one.
Yeah.
I guess we saw each other that night. We'd never actually met each other before. And at that party, most of us all knew each other. So it was kind of like, oh, who's this guy? We got talking, and from then on, we went on a few dates. He kind of, he stalked me for a while. He was suddenly showing up to all my friends' parties.
Just coincidence. Pure coincidence.
So he
says. And this is here in Melbourne?
In Melbourne, yep.
And you were what, teenagers? 19?
Yeah, so I was 17. Yeah, we were both 17 actually. Yeah, in year 12.
The end of year 12, yeah.
August, yeah. And that's really where it started. We saw each other a bit. We went on a few dates and, yeah. That's that.
The rest is history.
And you when was the first time he showed any inkling of the military? Was it from the start, or?
Yeah, I remember him mentioning pretty early on that he wanted to join. I can't remember exactly when, but he was playing footy at the time, and he did break his back. Early days.
That's
he had
right.
a footy injury, yeah. And crazy. It was kind of after that he was on. It was almost bed rest for a couple of months, and he did mention during that time that he'd applied he'd been rejected because of the injury. And from then on he said, when he was good to go, he'd do it again and try again. So, yeah, pretty early on. We knew pretty early on.
You were quite supportive, obviously. I mean, what
was
your reaction?
I mean, I was young. We were young. I had no idea where this relationship was going to end up. So... I thought it'd be a good thing for him to do and a good experience. So, yeah.
What were you anticipating being a military partner of a soldier? What was going through your mind?
Again, I really wasn't sure. I actually didn't know much about the army and the defense force. I had no idea. I think we were probably 18, 19, were we?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just started uni. I knew that would mean that he'd probably be living elsewhere, like interstate. And I guess at that stage, I was fine with that. We were doing our own thing anyway. I had no idea what it was going to end up like. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Joel, I think for you from memory, and correct me if I'm wrong, the idea of serving to you was very much also about being deployed overseas somewhere. I think you particularly had your sights set on Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, you know, when 9/11 happened, I was 10 and all the media is just flooded with content regarding that. And then you see military footage, you could say, on every form of media. And as a young boy, that was really influential. And I loved the team sport, you know, culture, love discipline, physically active, that sort of stuff. And joining the army was always something that was there. And I never knew that I wasn't going to be great at school, but the signs were there pretty early. And I thought the military is just perfect. So I think it was like 17 or 18, I started looking into it properly and then joined. But yeah, the ultimate goal was to deploy. You know, you don't see on TV people joining the army and staying in country for 6 years. And that wasn't what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go overseas.
And then that did eventuate. And so yeah. What effect did that have on this young relationship?
Yeah, at the time, I remember Joel mentioning that he was going to Afghanistan. He was on the next trip. We were living interstate, so we were doing long distance at that stage. We were seeing each other probably every couple of weeks.
Through the Kapooka and Singleton, or you were being posted at this stage?
I was at 7 at this stage.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so he was in Adelaide, living in Adelaide, and I was still back in Melbourne, still at uni. Yeah, it was just, it was actually a weird feeling. Like, I just didn't know where the relationship was going at that stage. We'd had a couple of breaks prior to that. And I just thought, yeah, do it. Like, go. I'm here. I'll support you. And I guess we'll just see what happens when you get back.
And it was your final year of nursing. Your final year of nursing as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, so it was. It was a big year. It was a big year for both of us. So I had that to focus on. Which kept me busy, I guess.
Yeah. So you were studying nursing
I
at
was,
this stage.
Yeah.
Okay. So final year, so what, 3 years of study or whatever it was.
Yep.
Okay. And your now other half sort of upping and offing to a faraway land.
Yeah. Yep.
Pretty intense.
Yeah, it was. It was. I think it was, I mean, Joel, like even throughout the whole time he was away, he was always good at just like, you know, putting me at ease. The times where I'd worry or you know, be unsure about what was going on, I remember I wouldn't hear from him for a few days and I'd be like, is everything okay? But I guess in these days, like having FaceTime as well, like that always helped. Yeah. We were able to FaceTime still. It was almost like if I didn't remember that he was overseas, it was just like he was back in Adelaide. Yeah. So, yeah, it was easy that in that sense,
yeah.
Probably quite different from what you experienced in your
deployments. The first time I went overseas, it was just letters, and Danielle used to smuggle the odd bit of scotch or bourbon in through the mail as well.
Yeah, wow.
So you'd come home from patrol or something, and your bed would be either full or not of letters and packages, and you always felt a bit for the guys who may be single. We were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
Because you got letters from kids and schools, et cetera. I think it's much better for, especially for the kids and partners now, that you can have that open communication.
Definitely.
So you've got your own dreams going on here. Mm. You know, you've finished school. You're in uni doing nursing. How did that play out over that time? Did you finished university and then just picked up a job nursing, or did you? Because it would have been there would have been a bit of to-ing and fro-ing. He's in Adelaide, you're in Melbourne. How did that play out?
Yeah, so I finished my nursing and pretty much got a job straight away. I started the following year, it was. So you were back, I'm pretty sure.
2014,
I think you were back, We even were speaking about like what the next steps were really. So he was back in Adelaide. I was still in Melbourne. I was still travelling up every second weekend. He was coming down as much as he could because his family were all here, obviously.
And there was never a concern around like, you know, would we stay together? It was really difficult when you're 21 or 22 and you've got a relationship where you just see each other maybe less than that.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what are we doing here? Like, where's our lives headed? Yeah. And, you know, I was coming into the final part of like the initial contract of a 4-year infantry contract, you could say. And, you know, where I was going from there, I had no idea. But, you know, something did happen shortly after we returned from Bali or we got back from Afghan that really changed, you know, our trajectory and probably for the better.
Yeah. Mm. That's an interesting comment. I'd love to come back to that because I was reflecting over the YouTube, the Life on the Line podcast and some interesting comments you had there. But I suppose just to round that out from my perspective, Elisa, did you have a sense of the military and had the military support you or recognize you at all, or were you just kind of this passive bystander along the journey?
Yeah, I was pretty much just like a bystander at that stage.
Because you're not renting, you're not...
We went together in their eyes, really. I do remember Joel coming to me one day and we were speaking and he said, you know, I think I'm going to stay on.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Like, this was not the deal? Like,
oh, that's right.
So it was supposed to be 1 year. So originally he was only doing a gap year.
Yeah.
And then he decided to sign up for the, 4 years. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, I was studying.
Did you say, okay, that's fine?
Well, I probably didn't. But, I feel like I was supportive in your decision.
But you weren't happy about
I probably wasn't happy for a little while, but I got over it. But then obviously looking back, you know, those 4 years after and when he did say he wanted to sign on, I got it. I understood, like, it was a career for him and he really enjoyed it and he'd made the most amazing group of friends and mates, like, for life. Mm. And, yeah, that was really special to see. So as much as I thought, here we go, like, what I just was worried about our future. I thought, you know, I don't really want to leave Melbourne. I've got all my friends and family here.
Yeah.
And I guess the decision was really just up in the air. We didn't really come to an agreement. And then, this happened. So it kind of just made our decision for us. And, like, it's weird. There's been so many times, like, throughout these last few years where things just happened when we weren't really sure what was next. I guess it's, we were meant to be.
I forced your hand to marry me.
So it's a really important, question, I think, in my mind for young partners and young families going, what does joining the military mean?
Absolutely.
And it must be really intimidating in a way. And so many, and I wonder at the time how well the military does that to almost onboard people, and partners, I mean, I get that you guys were separated or not, you weren't living together in separate states, but there's always a message in there for a young man or woman who's got a partner in the military and joining it. Maybe we could do something better in that.
And to me, I think what I've sort of just learnt in this little chat is the fact that the military doesn't necessarily just recognise a girlfriend or a boyfriend. Mm. It's got to be more than that before they kind of take you on as part of that military community. Would that be a fair thing to say?
Totally. Even like another example of that is after Joel had his accident, like the army were helping and doing a lot for him. I was not recognised in any of that. You know, like his parents were flown over, given accommodation and everything. And when it was asked, what about Elisa? It was like, well, technically she's
not official.
Do you live together? Do you, are you married? Do you have kids? Do you, and it was like, no. And so,
Bureaucracy, it was mad. Well, that I guess also will lay into, I guess, where your support systems came from. I mean, obviously it sounds like Joel was very well connected through the military connections, other ESOs, ex-service organisations that stepped in, family support. Mm-hmm. Where did your supports come from? Firstly, during his time in Afghanistan and then following on from the accident, the life-changing accident.
Yeah, so my family have been like incredible, like from the very, always. But in particular, like during all of this, they have always been there for me. My mum, my dad, my brother, my aunties, uncles, cousins, grandparents, everyone has just been amazing. All of Joel's family, Joel's parents and brother. if it wasn't for them, there's no way I could have gotten through it all. You know, like when others didn't step up, they were there. Mm. Yeah.
And that's not to say people didn't step up. It's, you know, we needed a lot of support. Yeah. Well, Elisa did.
It was probably not the right word then. But yeah.
No, like, I know what you're saying though. But, you know, we needed help from every angle, you know, from a material point of view, from a support network as well. Because, you know, I had a younger brother as well who needed help. You know, Elisa needed help in her own ways and not being recognised formally by, you know, de facto.
Yeah.
And she fell through the cracks in some way. But, you know, Elisa's family, during the time me being in hospital, they were incredible. They would come see me all the time. You know, they haven't wavered ever in their support for us. And, you know, my family are the same. But supporting the families of the one that served is so important.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones who I lean on almost, or people that serve lean on most, you know, their loved ones, their partner. So if they're not doing it right, like.
Well, if there's one thing I hope we can do, Ailes, is we can, beyond the barracks, can move the needle a bit on that discussion, looking after partners. We're both pretty passionate about that. Yep. And I think that starts, you know, if you're going to support an individual holistically, that starts with relationships, no matter what form they take, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone in the military doesn't want to do it. It's just this big green machine that kind of needs a tick box to move and make a decision. And
Where do you draw the line as to, you know, who you can reach out to support?
Yeah.
You need lived experience. You need people who have been through the process of had good and bad experiences that want to give back to the organisation or the group that supported them or perhaps could have been better. Yep. Lived experience is the most important part when you're consulting to get a better experience for people in the future.
Of course.
So it's well known, well, pretty well known, your accident, as you referred to it, Elisa. Do you want to just bring us back to that point maybe and just give us an overview for the people who might not have the understanding and then you kind of move from there?
Yeah, so it was a Saturday night in 2014, 31st of August. I was in Adelaide because obviously 7RAR is posted there, and I went out with my mates who I played football with in the civvy team, and I don't recall much of the day or the night, to be honest, but when I did have my accident, what happened was I'd fallen off a staircase. It was a 3-meter fall onto my back, and when I did, I shattered my C5 vertebrae, which pushed into my spinal cord, which is why I'm a C5 quadriplegic. And from there, I guess that's when my injury really took over and controlled the first 12 months, 18 months of our lives. And now we control it, but that was where, the accident happened.
I can only imagine, I mean, trying to put myself in that scene at the time, the chaos, the panic that ensued when that accident happened. At what point, Elisa, were you made aware of what happened and what the prognosis was? Can you remember that at all?
Yeah, I do. I had been at a friend's birthday party that night. It was a Saturday night, as Joel said. And I remember I got home probably around midnight. I'd been speaking to Joel throughout the night, and he mentioned that he was heading out with his mates, which was pretty standard for the Saturday night. I remember actually getting a Snapchat. At the time, like, Snapchat was the thing. And I remember getting a Snapchat at about midnight before I went to bed, and it was a picture of Joel and his best mate. And they were at the venue, you know. Joel had his glasses on, which ended up being a funny story after his accident. And they just sent a photo of themselves together just smiling. And if you don't know, Snapchat, after 5 or 10 seconds, the photo disappears. But for some reason, I screenshotted that photo that night. And then it was probably about, I went to bed, I spoke to Joel. He was like, yep, I'm out. Everything's good. And at about 1:30, 2 a.m., I got a call. I was asleep, and it was a no number, like just a private number. And I didn't answer it. I just, didn't. And then after a couple of minutes, it rang again. And I thought, this is weird. But again, I just saw, like, maybe it was just, I don't know, Joel being silly, or like he's one of his mates or something. I don't know. I had no idea. I was half asleep. Like, and then it rang again, and I thought, I better answer this. You know, I'm not sure what's going on here. And I answered it. And it was a lady, and
was it the
at paramedic? That moment, no, it was one of the doctors at the hospital. And she said, oh, hi, my name's blah, blah. I'm a doctor at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. And I'm like, okay. And it still just didn't click in that moment that Joel, like something had happened. And she said, I've got Joel here. He's asked me to call you. He's had a fall and we think, I'm not even sure if they were certain at that stage, we think he's got a neck fracture. And I thought, okay, like I'm a nurse. I know neck fracture. Like, is he okay? And she's like, he's fine. But he will be going into a surgery to fuse his fracture and stabilize it basically. And she didn't really say anything else. And I'm just thinking, okay, that's fine. Like he's broken his back a couple of years ago. He's all good. Like I just never thought it was that bad. And she actually did before she left. She said, is there any chance you can come in? And I said, I'm in Melbourne. And she said, oh, okay. I didn't realize that. And I didn't even think to like ask, have you called Joel's parents? Like what? I had no idea. And she actually put me onto the phone. She put Joel onto the phone and he was like dazed. Like he was telling me his credit card details, which is a really funny thing now.
I was like,
but
Elisa,
like,
I think I said, take
he said,
this number
write
down.
This down. He's like, Elisa, have you got a pen? And I'm like, Joel, it's like 2 a.m. What's going on? And he's like, I'm fine. He was just saying, I'm fine, but write this number down. Just silly me, I'm writing this number down. I had no idea concussion. What was going on.
Yeah.
And that was it. Like, he's like, okay, I got to go or something. And she took the phone and that was it. And I just thought, what is going on? And I'm like, he's having a spinal fusion. Like, this is big. Like, I didn't even know at that time. Like, I didn't even ask, like, can he move his body? Is he paralyzed? Like, I had no idea. I went to mum and dad's room. I woke mum and dad up and I'm like, I just had this really weird call. Joel's in hospital. He's had an accident. I was too afraid to ring his parents because I wasn't even sure if they'd not, like, if they knew. And I wasn't even sure if it was, like, anything worth worrying them about, to be honest. Mm. And then, yeah, I don't think I slept. Like, I remember laying in mum and dad's bed for a few hours and the next thing I remember it was morning. And that's when Joel's mum called me or I called her and they were on their way to the airport. So they were on the 6 a.m. flight to Adelaide. And I just remember thinking, what am I going to do? What am I supposed to do? There was no way of contacting Joel at that stage. Like,
what about my mates? Did any of them call you?
I can't remember. I have no recollection of them calling you. And I don't think so. Like, I don't even think I spoke to any of them. I just didn't know what to do. Your mum and dad had said that they'd let me know once they got there what was going on. And, yeah, it wasn't until – I don't even remember how I found out, like, that it was spinal damage or anything. Mm. I think it must have just been when they got there or – yeah, it was just all very unclear. And then I tried to keep myself busy that day. I went out to a market. Mum's like, come on, let's just go and get some fresh air. I went to a market and something that I remember is I saw one of Joel's best friends at the market. And I couldn't bring myself to tell her what had happened. And I just remember just ignoring her and like trying to walk the other way. Oh, like she didn't see me.
Yeah.
And she knows about this story now. But yeah, I just remember thinking, I can't even speak to you right now. I've got to go the other way. I don't know what's going on. And then, yeah, I flew up pretty much the next morning then.
Yeah.
He was in surgery for like the 8 hours that day.
So the picture must have been becoming quite clear at that stage as to how serious and significant your injury was.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was Joel's friend or his mum. Someone had called me and said, yeah, things aren't good. Like you better come up. So, yeah, I got on the next flight the next morning and flew up and he just got out of surgery. Yeah, so he was in surgery pretty much the whole day after the accident. Yeah, and I remember walking in and just being like, what? Like, he was like swollen. He was puffy. He had like wires and tubes and I'm like, this is bad. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. That's when it hit me.
That would take quite a while to kind of come to terms with. At what stage did the Defence Force show their heads and any support?
Yeah, my mates were there next day.
Yeah.
The rank, as far as rank, CO, RSM came in, so Commanding Officer, Regimental Sergeant Major came in to see us, see my family and I don't recall what day that was because it was all a blur, Harry. Yeah. But, you know, they appointed someone, and again, this is where it comes really important for lived experience to consult with defence for similar situations moving mm-hmm. forward, because we had someone appointed to us who promised the world and was not there when it came to helping us, helping mum and dad at the airport, when it came to meeting them at the hospital. And at a time when my family needed it most, that fell down. Yeah. So that can be improved moving forward. But the Defence Force were really good in that they appointed a welfare manager for when I came to Melbourne, who would come into the hospital and see me quite a bit. But early days, you know, it wouldn't be 5 minutes without having visitors, and people had to be asked to leave so the next visitors could come in. And, you know, that was a really good insight into the support network Army has.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. that those kind of informal channels and with friends. And what about you, Elisa? What did you feel, you know, was defence wrapping itself around you and the...
Yeah, I think when we got there, very much so. Like, I think it was the point of leaving Adelaide where suddenly those supports disappeared.
Mm.
Not when we got there. Like, they helped Peter and Tracy, Joel's parents, like, with everything. The flights, anything they needed.
Your accommodation, did they support you?
Yeah, like food, everything they needed. But, yeah, not me, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I'm laying there in bed thinking what the hell's happening with everything,
mm.
you know, I'm worried about my family who have flown over, and I'm worried about Elisa. And I later hear that she was just thrown into a room last minute and having to share a shower in, like, prison cell type showers because they couldn't accommodate her. And not in a prison, I want to make that clear.
Yeah,
yeah, but they were pretty substandard.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And pretty again, basic. You know, mm. just put her in a B&B, one bedroom. It's not too hard.
Yeah.
And I guess it's just that it's recognising a spouse, as it's called, or a partner, and you know, you need to be married or recognised.
Mm. Yeah. I understand there's formalities, but there's extenuating circumstances, sure. something like this.
Oh, absolutely. And it's 20, you know, it's 2000s. So, yeah. you know, I think we can be, you know, definitely be a bit more sophisticated.
Exactly. And obviously it was quite evident by that stage that this was someone very significant
yeah.
in your life. You yeah. wanted her by your side
from
the get-go.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a funny conversation I had with Dad 2 or 3 days in. Because I just had a hard chat with Elisa, and, you know, basically she solidified where she wanted to be, which is with me. And, you know, in my mind, I was 22. I always forget the age. What
22.
Was 22.
Yeah.
There we go. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, I was 22 and I thought, that's it. I've got to marry this woman. But at the time, I was heavily sedated, still suffering concussion. And I told Dad, ring my mate who's in Dubai, yeah. one of the guys coming back, buy a diamond because I'm going to put in the ring and propose to Elisa. And, you know, he did that without even questioning it. 6 months down the track, he came to see me in the hospital one day. He's like, do you still want this diamond? I thought, what are you talking about? He's like, yeah, you remember, you made me buy a diamond. Oh,
you owe me 10 grand.
Yeah. I was like, shit, I forgot about that.
This is the diamond, by the way.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. There it is, yeah. But I completely forgot about it. But, yeah, I mean, the early days, Elisa was the rock that I needed. And so was my mum, dad, and my uncle, I want to make clear, who flew over.
Yeah.
Amazing. And I do remember, Joel, that you had sort of like – a light bulb moment, so to speak, that you remember the time where you thought Elisa's the one.
Funny you said that because we were talking about this last night, and I don't think there can be a light bulb moment when you realise you want to spend your life with someone. It just moments in time, specific events that happen, and when we eventually, we can get to it in a second, but when we went and lived in America for rehab, you know, we'd identified, like, we'd been through some really rough times together. And Elisa was always there to support me, and I was too, where I could support Elisa. And I guess that's the true definition of a relationship and love, when you can love someone when they're sick and need the most, but then also love them when they're having a great time. And we did both.
Mm.
And Elisa does that for me still. And, you know, after 12 months in America, it was no doubt that Elisa was the one. I just had to ask her parents.
Right.
Just had to ask her parents. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And
get
I did. I did the right thing. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And Elisa, I suppose by the same token, much the same way that the love evolved for Joel and it just happened over time, was it the same for you that, I mean, you were in it for the long haul and you it was quite evident, you know, what the future was going to look like with Joel's injury, that you were prepared to stick around?
Yeah, yeah. I think definitely a few months after his accident, He was back in Melbourne and he spent 12 months at the Royal Talbot. And it was there that I just never wanted to leave. Like, I just wanted to be there every day. And I remember people.
You were.
Yeah, I remember people saying, you need to, for your own mental health, just like leave and go and do something for you. And I remember getting like upset at them and like being a bit pissed off at them and like, mm-hmm. Why are you telling me what to do? Like, this is what I want to do. So let me do it. Like, you know. And I guess it was then that I was like, yeah, that's it. Like, it's done.
And what kind
it's
of
done. Yeah,
it's done.
We're done.
Signed and sealed.
It's a done deal.
What kind of obstacles did all of this throw up in your progression in your career and other things that you had going on in your young life at that stage?
Well, I was working at that time. I was probably in my first or second year at work. Luckily, my workplace was only about 5 minutes from the hospital. So I would, if I was on a morning shift, I'd go there and then head over to the hospital pretty much straight after, and then and vice versa. I'd be at the hospital in the morning and then head to work in the afternoon. It really didn't change much of my work life. I still worked pretty normally.
Yeah, but given you had to do shifts, they were really good to allow you to just do.
They were very
days.
Yeah, they were very flexible. They yeah. knew what was going on. They let me. I think I might have dropped a day. Mm. I was only doing about 0.8 at the time. So, yeah, they were great. So really from like career-wise, it didn't change much at that point, yeah.
And at this stage, I suppose also you could see the impact of the mateship that Joel probably had come across in his service time and how that was weighing into his life and his recovery and your world, becoming part of your world.
Yeah, I definitely, after his accident, realised that, you know, he'd definitely made mates for life. Like these, his friends, there was not a day at the hospital in the 12 months that there was not someone there, like, and in particular, those army mates, like, they would fly down, his best mates would fly down every few weeks, they'd take it in turns, they'd, you know, there was even a little unit at the hospital that you could go and stay in if you had someone come down, and I reckon of the 12 months, we had it for like 6 months.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The nurses were hating you.
Yeah. The boys bring there you was down always, an esky or something.
Yeah,
yeah, it was like a party in the unit. It's,
that's
you know,
right, a bit of morale.
And I think even just the nurses were just so surprised. I remember them always saying that of all the patients we've ever had through here, no one has had this many visitors. Like, yeah, they would kick people out. They would put rules
not,
on like
not
visitors
welcome
for Joel.
Sign.
Yeah, like always. He didn't. And another little thing. He never ate a meal at the Royal Talbot, like one of their meals, because every single night, whether it was Tracy, Joel's mum, going back home or preparing something the night before, bringing it in for dinner, not just for us, but for the 10 people that were there also visiting.
Wow.
When it happened to be dinner time, like there was always someone bringing dinner in. Like, yeah, it was
incredible.
Amazing. Like the support was like unbelievable. We'll never be able to thank people
speaks volumes
enough for that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Hey, tell me about the States. You did your rehab. How long were you there for, and what was the nature? You know, why you go there?
Yeah, when I had my injury, rehab was few and far between in regards to quality places, but. There was a place called Project Walk at the time. It doesn't exist now, but back then it was the world's best practice for paralysis recovery.
Yep.
And we were told about it early days in the hospital, but you know we pushed it to the side. But after we got out of hospital, started having a couple of fundraisers, and that was our goal to get to Southern California and San Diego at Project Walk.
Yep.
And so we went there for, I think it was 6 weeks the first time, and then just on a year the next time. But in the 6 weeks that we were there in the first time, there was no rehab done in the chair. Everything was dynamic, and it wasn't about getting you walking again. It wasn't about getting you to where you once were. It was about getting you to your optimal capacity in regards to being a quad.
Yeah.
And then also internally, you know, finding the purpose and the identity inside, because the way Americans look at people in wheelchairs, they just look at someone. The way Australians look at us in wheelchairs, they'll stare like we've got foreheads.
Yeah, right.
Still happens now, but I'm cool with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But in America, I felt comfortable. I could be myself over there. Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah,
and what was your experience? You travelled as well.
Yeah, I was over with Joel, and yeah, it was incredible. It literally changed Joel's perspective. I feel like we left that 12 months at hospital and Joel was not in a good place mentally, even physically, really. He'd done the rehab that he had to do to leave the hospital. Yeah. But it was what's next? Like, what is this life now? You know, it looked pretty grim. It really did. Like, are we ever going to be able to have kids? Like, can we travel? Can we even travel? Like, just even doing the research to find out whether Joel could actually fly. Mm. Like, I don't know. Luckily, yeah. I was a nurse. I had a bit of a background in, like, you know, like health. Catheters and things like that. That, yeah. you know, if I wasn't, there's no way Joel could have gone to America because if something had happened, yeah, I would have had to educate myself and teach myself all this because it was only him and I.
Yeah. I was going to say, because how much did your nursing background then play into Joel's recovery? Yeah. And
It helped. It helped a lot. Like, even just with that catheters, like he would have had to go back into hospital to have catheter changes every, like, I don't even remember how often now, but like they allowed us to do that at home because I was qualified doing that. So just those little things, the knowledge of, like, you know, pressure sores and all those little things that could have been catastrophic, but having the knowledge and how to prevent it without having to go out and do education and,
How good's she doing? First time she's ever shared this story, by the way.
So good.
It's amazing. And you know what? I'm sitting here, especially after that last bite, I think it's starting to make sense why you said on the YouTube, you know, that you feel lucky and blessed. And when I hear you talking, Elise, about, you know, family support and friends support and all the rest of it, and then you to be a nurse and obviously got a massive caring gene in your DNA, you know, I can see where you're coming from, because it's very hard for me to sit here and go, I can't imagine what it's like. But to hear you say, but I'm so grateful is such a powerful thing to hear, and I really get it now.
Yeah. You know, the thing that gets people out of trauma is the support. And as bad as it can be, like that this incident for me was the best thing that happened to me in my life.
Yeah. You've said that before, and it still kind of blows my mind a little, like I'm still computing that a little. But
yeah, and you can't appreciate it till you've sort of been in there. And
yeah. That's why. You've mentioned, you know, obviously hard times and times that you've had to work through. I imagine in the States there would have been psychological counselling and those types of things as part of it maybe. But what I'm interested in is, and I'd like to hear about that from both you individually, but I'm also interested in as a couple, you know, when you do go through the hard times. I mean, every couple has a hard time. I can only imagine there's additional stresses on that, of course. If I can put it like, do you have advice for people to say, you know, that these are the things we did, this is how we move through these?
I think we really just worked together. Like, if Joel was having a bad day, and there were lots of them in America as well, wasn't there really? Like, we only had each other there. You know, we spoke to our parents and our families and friends and everything, but we only had each other. And I guess I just thought that on those bad days, like, even if I was feeling crappy or whatever, I just had to step up for that day, because if I also was crappy and down and whatever, I knew that it would just make him fall apart even more. So, and Joel did the same, because I had my days in America where I, just wanted to go home really. Like, it got hard. It did get hard. But we've been able to just read each other like that. It's not really anything I don't know, it just works.
Yeah, listening.
I mean, we work on it, but.
Yeah, but listening, you know, I've learned so much from Elisa from what she's taught me and vice versa. And when it comes to the times where things are really shit, we sort of reflect on those. And there was one day we had a really big argument in Carlsbad at the places we were staying, and I said, fuck this, I'm going out for a walk, you know, call it a walk, whatever. And I was so angry. You know, we're probably disagreeing over something so stupid, yeah, but, you know, it was cabin fever at some point.
It was just us.
I went down the hill to this little car park lot we're in, and being a quad, I can't push up hills. And I was like, well, the stubborn one in me says just cop it, just sit there. So I think I sat there for an hour thinking, I need Elisa to come and get me. How do I bring myself to call her? Elisa, I'm just down the road. Can you come and get me?
And I'm still shitty, but yeah, I can come and get me. Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, we've had so many of those situations, not the disagreements as such, but you know, where we've lent on each other when we needed it most, and in America especially.
Yeah.
You know, the first time we were away from our family for 12 months with the injury.
Yep.
You touched on briefly there, Joel, the idea that you've had some lessons that you've learnt from Elisa. Can you elaborate on that and vice versa? What have you learnt from each other through all of this?
This is a hard question because, yeah, I feel like we probably have learnt a lot without even realising. Like, I think just the strength that Joel shows, like, mentally has been able to help me mentally as well. Like, knowing that he is okay and that he pushes, it helps me keep going. That's probably the biggest thing for me.
Yeah. I think Elisa's calm nature, so early days, being a young, immature male, you know, very reactive, not thinking about what I would say or do. And I would sit back and watch Elisa if there was a disagreement between others or if there was something happening that probably wasn't too nice, Elisa just wouldn't respond and she'd just sit back and take it in and still behave really maturely and diplomatically. And I never did back then, but I've sort of learned from Elisa that first thing to do is step back, think about it and then react. That's something I've learned like early days from Elisa when there's conflict around us and she just take a step back. Yeah. Take
calm
it in.
Good,
yeah.
Calm and measured. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a good lesson to know. Yeah. What I'm curious as well, Joel, I mean, you've obviously very much shaped your future around your injury. You educate others, you speak to others, and that I know was out of your comfort zone, I think, from the beginning. And you've pushed through it all and you've forged a career out of this. You've also spoken very openly about some of the interesting challenges you've come across as a result of this injury, from catheters to bowel accidents, those sorts of things. Elisa, how has that, how have you felt implicated in all of that, to have all of that out in the open, such intimate details?
So that to me, like Joel, that is Joel's therapy. Mm-hmm. That is what, that's how he keeps going and he gets through what he does. You know, I think in the beginning, he was very closed about all this stuff, didn't really want to speak publicly about anything for the fear of, probably putting too much out there or
just judgment.
But I think he's learned that that's his way of dealing with it. And I see how much mentally, how much happier he is when he puts himself out there like that and he can talk about it openly and freely without that judgment. It's helped. It's helped us both. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Just normalizing it, you know.
Yeah.
Just like you talk about, there's no toilet paper.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? I've got to use a catheter to go to the toilet.
Yeah. You know?
And the first time we flew to America, we both learnt about what happens when you put an incontinent male on a, or a person on an aircraft that's pressurized, you know?
Yeah.
So,
Well,
now we've learned.
Somewhere over the Pacific
not
Ocean.
Let that happen,
right.
But
yeah. Somewhere over the Pacific Ocean, yeah. I shit my pants.
Yeah.
And like that was such an embarrassing moment, but I thought, no, hang on. Don't let it get to us. Then we started laughing about it.
Yeah.
We normalized it. And then we spoke about it heaps following. And it was just a funny moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't help it. So just normalize it.
Yeah.
You did have some assistance from ex-service organizations, and how much did that include the family unit or continues to include? You've now got kids. What does that look like from the veteran and the family perspective from an ESO?
I guess the first introduction to an ESO was when I was in hospital still in the Talbot, and this bloke came up to me along with people from the sub-branch RSL Greensboro, and this guy said to me, mate, his name was Glenn Ferrerotto. He said, mate, I'm ready to employ you whenever you want to, when you want to start. You can work as much or as little as you want. And he'll probably say, I never worked in the 6 years I worked for him. But, you know, he came and said, look, you know, don't worry, I got you. When you get out, I've got you. Greensboro RSL, along with Anzac House, Jeff Jackson stood up and came to my family and said, we're going to help you. And, you know, to get home, my house needed to be renovated to be made accessible. And that's a pretty big cost and something that I didn't want my mum and dad to do, because I said, if you're going to have to pay for it, I'm not letting you do that. I'll go elsewhere. You know, I don't know what elsewhere was, but I just didn't want them to foot the bill. And RSL stepped in, community support. But, you know, when they did, they paid for the renovations. They paid for our place. So I could move home into a place that was accessible and I had quality of life. And then they continued to support us through my rehabilitation. They paid for some of the rehab both here in Australia and America. They paid for Elisa and I flights.
They paid for our first trip.
Yeah.
And Project Walk. And most of the second.
Yeah. And, you know, they're not paying flights for us to go on holidays. They're paying for our flights for rehab. And, you know, they were incredible. And,
yeah. Mm. Yep.
And then when the ESO space, you know, the employment piece came into it, well, that's where I started to forge some purpose and my own responsibilities and importance at work. And for what Glenn did for me in 6 years, I can't thank him enough. Mm. But the ESO piece was really important as well.
And for that, I mean, you felt very much part and parcel of the experience and of Joel's journey. You weren't sidelined by the sounds of things.
No, not at all. No, RSL, Greensboro RSL came. They actually spoke to Joel's mum. They called me and they said, what can we do? Like, what do you need? They were there from the very beginning, always have been, still are.
Yeah.
Like, still check on us. What do we need? Is there anything they can do? And now for our family. But yeah, they are the reason our life headed in this direction. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, the proof is there in that if you look at people I was in the hospital with now or who are there now, they have the same injury, that don't have the same support network. Their life hasn't taken the same path that mine has. And I'm where I am, not because of me individually, but because of the people around us and the organisations that supported us, and RSL, Anzac House, and now Melbourne Legacy. They've got a massive part to play. And without them, this wouldn't happen.
Mm. What a great to hear.
Things could have been so different.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Wow, fascinating.
And that was purely just them reading about us in the paper as well. Like they... The guys from Greensboro RSL just read something and, you know, just called. They said, we just got your number. I don't even know how they got our number, but just called and,
They came to our engagement party.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like family.
Like family.
They are family. Yeah.
Extended family.
Yeah.
And so then, I mean, you got married, as it turns out. Congratulations. Today's your wedding anniversary.
It is.
What one is it? What?
Our fifth today.
Okay, that's
milestone.
Good.
Yep. Yeah, that's a milestone.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
Happy anniversary.
Sorry. Oh,
there you go. Doing the podcast.
Yeah. And then tell us about the kids coming along. How did that all happen? Yeah. Was that a discussion? You both wanted children in your future?
Yeah, we both had talked about kids. We both wanted kids. After we got married, it was probably the year after that we knew we would have to go through IVF to have children. So we spoke about maybe just getting things started. We weren't even sure of the process. We had no idea. We went to a few like info sessions that they told us to go to. You know, I remember sitting there thinking we're the only young ones in here as well. That was really weird. Like at the time,
really?
I just thought, we were, weren't we? By far. And it was really just like, okay.
And
I didn't know what to think, you know.
But why were the only young ones there?
Are you testing me?
No, I'm like, why would you? Yeah, because like, you know, we were ready to have kids or whatever. Sorry, I didn't mean to test you. I was like, the reason we were the only young ones is because we couldn't actually conceive.
And
older couples who obviously tried naturally
over years. They'd gone through all of those processes first before realising.
So we decided to do it. I think started in like the December, I think it was that year that we went. February we had our first embryo transfer. And yeah, it worked the first time.
We're
really fortunate. Yeah. So we have four embryos. The first one worked. That's Esme. And then it was probably like Joel at the 6 month mark was like, I'm ready to do this again. Oh. I'm like, really? I'm not sure I am.
Yeah.
But then it got to about 9 months and we knew that we wanted to have them pretty close together. And so we thought, we don't know if we're going to get lucky this time and it work first go. So maybe we should look at going and seeing what we need to do. And yeah, we had our second transfer and that worked the first time again.
Wow.
So
that's great.
Yeah.
That's Luna.
Yeah. I mean, dare I say, both Harry and I, you know, we're parents. We've been there, done that with the little ones. Parenting is hard work. And then you add in added challenges. How has that all worked? I mean, it sounds like you are such a hands-on dad, Joel. From everything that I've seen, from everything that I hear, you are so involved in your gorgeous girls. How does that play out?
Yeah, we didn't really know. When we decided to have kids, we just thought, like, we've got no idea. Like, no one knows, I guess, when they have kids. But then we had this added, like, I guess my concern was that Joel, like, it might put Joel in a bad place knowing the things that he can't physically do for the kids. So I was a bit worried about that when Esme was born. And I just think, yeah, that we spoke about it, but you don't really know until you go through it, like what you need, what you can do, what you can't do. And there were definitely things that affected Joel. You know, he can't bath the girls. He can't change their nappies. He can't dress them. You know, all those little things.
Technically with a bad habit.
You know, but at the time when it's your first child, you're like, that was hard. And it was hard for me to see. And I feel like I so often just like tried to play it down. Like, it's fine. It's fine. Don't worry. But like, it was hurting me inside obviously as well. But I just didn't want to show that. Yeah. I just, you know, he didn't need that as well.
But again, like, Elisa was amazing at reading the room there and seeing that I needed her to at least show empathy or sympathy for me and say, I'm sorry that it hurts. You know, I can't do anything for you, but you know, I'm here for you.
Yeah.
Because that's all I needed to hear.
Yeah.
And she said that. And she did that.
Yeah.
No. And everything he can't do, like, there's 10 things that he can. Yeah. You know, he's there's nothing more than the girls love than just jumping on his lap and going for a ride, or Luna likes to go and watch birds and the cars and, you know, other things that other kids probably don't get to do. Yeah. Like, they don't get to go for rides on their dad's lap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, because of my injury, I can't work full time. Probably can, but I'm just, you know, taking that one there. But I don't work full time, right? Because it allows me to do rehab on another day or do my talks on another day. But then also, for the same part, on that day where I'm not working, I get to hang out with Elisa and Luna and Esme.
Yeah.
Whether we go to a cafe, which we do regularly, or we go to a park, or I watch them play in the backyard, I get to do that because I can't work because of my injury. Now, that's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
That's so fortunate. So
such a positive way to spin it, mate. I reckon it's cool. No, not spin it, to reframe it, which I've heard you.
Cognitive reframing, absolutely. Yeah. So important, you know, it's so important because I was at the barber a few weeks ago and Esme wanted to get on my lap and I couldn't pick her up and I thought, man, this sucks again, you know, the injury coming into play. But then I thought, hang on, you're at the barber on your day off with your family. Have a look at that. That's the beauty.
Yeah.
And the empathy that our girls show for such a young age, the understanding, Luna, 15 months old, I say, Luna, can you please pick up my phone? She'll pick it up and she'll hand it to me. Not throw it, hand it to me so I can grab it.
Yeah.
Those sort of things, that's priceless.
Yeah.
Guys, it has been such a joy to have you both here. And thank you very much, Elisa, for sharing and being so candid with the story. And thank you for sharing it with us. No one's heard this before from you. So
thank you.
It's amazing. And you've left me both, I mean, inspired by Joel listening and reading all the stuff, but I reckon you've inspired me more. The good humour, you can see your mates, like the way you talk and look at each other. And I want to say thank you for your service, but thank you for yours too. And I don't think that's said enough to partners. The military, no matter what level of engagement you have with it, it brings a certain kind of cachet about it, and I think you've acquitted yourself with excellence, and you deserve a good pat on the back for your service too, Elisa.
Thank you for having me on. Yeah,
yeah, well done.
It's been really good. Thank you.
Such a pleasure. Thanks, thank you. Cheers. Yeah, good I just love the... love the way you two still look at each other and you know, touch each other a little bit, and you know, there's nothing old or stale or anything there yet. So hang on to it.
We try.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah,
just really nice.
Yeah, I remember those days.
Yeah, back in the day. Yeah. Love it. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wasn't that awesome?
That was unbelievable just to hear the two of them together, what they've been through in their relationship and just the way they still look at each other and every now and again touch each other.
Yeah, yeah, they look like real friends or mates.
Absolutely.
And, made me a bit envious, you know, because I've been married a long time, Ailes, as you know, and that kind of compassion for each other was real standout for me. And what an unbelievable human Elisa is, you know. I mean, the challenge is obvious for Joel and the family, but she just seems in such good spirits and so good humoured after what has been an incredible story, an incredible journey.
Absolutely. And just that she's been so kind to share it with us and some very intimate details about their life and their lifestyle and how they've navigated all of that. So I think some really great takeaway messages.
Yeah, and great to hear the role of RSL plays. It's not that story's not told enough either, and was just they couldn't have been more happier with the support that they'd got from the RSL and some of the ESOs.
Very much. And the fact that it's the veteran is so important, but so is the person behind or next to that veteran.
Absolutely.
If this podcast episode raises any concerns for you, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. If you're a current or ex-service member of the ADF or a family member of a veteran or someone who's currently serving, you can access free and confidential 24/7 support from Open Arms Veterans and Families Counselling on 1800 011 046. Current serving members of the ADF and their families can also contact the All Hours Support Line on 1800 628 036 for confidential support. RSL Victoria is here to provide assistance and support to past and present service personnel and their families. Importantly, you don't have to be a member of the RSL to receive assistance from RSL Victoria. You only have to be a current or former member of the Australian Defence Force, our allies, or a dependent of either group. To access RSL support, you can reach out to your closest RSL sub-branch or contact RSL Victoria's Veteran Central Service on 1300 MILVET, 1300 645 838.